You're listening to Talking Baseball with Ed Randall, presented by MLB.com. He's Ed Randall. He's talking baseball. What more do you need?
Hi, everybody. I'm Ed Randall, Big Ed and Nora's baby boy, and welcome back to Ed Randall's Talking Baseball. From time to time, we're highlighting the iconic broadcast voices of our game. We welcome to the podcast, now in his 25th year of broadcasting for the Chicago White Sox, Ed Farmer. Longtime friend, great to have you on the podcast. When you look back on 25 years, does it seem like 25 years? Because to me, time's flying.
Yeah, it is. You know, I have this theory. It's only a theory that I've come up with. You try to get to 21 because then you're a legal age. At least most of us think we are anyway. Mentally, we're probably not there yet at 21. And when you get there, you don't look at anything because you've already crossed that bridge. You're 21. You can do whatever you want. Basically within the law. And then the next 21 years goes by and you go, hey, I'm 42. Where are those 21? Ed, get to 63. And now it's a different look. You're going, oh, time's running out. They say, I don't have enough time, but time's infinite. How do we run out of it? But we're running out of it.
You and I met in the Pacific Coast League. I was broadcasting. You were pitching. And you were back in AAA after having been in the majors for 3 years. At that time, you were with Milwaukee.
Yeah, I was. And they moved my arm swing down that spring training. They wanted a sidearm reliever. And my fastball at the time, when I went to the big leagues, was close to 100 miles an hour. And I'd been with the Cleveland Indians. And they had made a trade. The Milwaukee had made a trade. And I came over there. And they moved my arm slot. And I actually hurt my arm in Spokane. And then I got released. And it took me a surgery a year and a half later to get back to where I could actually use my arm again. And Frank Jobe did that surgery at Sentinella Hospital in Los Angeles in Inglewood, California. And 3 years later, I was pitching again, and then I went to the big leagues and made the All-Star team in 1980.
For those who don't know, your home games were played in a place called Hughes Stadium in Sacramento, with the first year, before I got there, a 233-foot left field fence. It was a track stadium. And then they moved home plate back and made it 251 feet. They called it the House of Thrills. They would announce in attendance. They didn't have turnstiles. It was a crazy place. And I was with the Spokane Ball Club. We once lost a game on a broken bat home run.
No question about it, because they had a screen in left field. I mean, it wasn't, you know, they at least put the screen up, but a pop-up was a home run. It's the only place I've ever been in baseball where I actually look forward to going to a road trip to go to another city. When you went to Tacoma in that league, you thought you were pitching in a Grand Canyon.
Right.
And the fences were 6 miles apart.
Right.
Because Hughes Stadium basically was a track stadium. And I think they played some football in there. But football had to be digested also. The right field fence at Hughes Stadium was a long way because you had the 100 yards there with a track running around it.
And the press box for the visiting broadcaster was past first base.
Yes.
Yeah. And I once called a 7-4-3 double play from left field. This, I would think, would be a dream job for a kid from Chicago.
Working for the team he grew up loving? It's a great... it's a great job. My mother walked me into Comiskey Park with two of my brothers when I was 5 years old. I was 5'1". I was this huge kid. And we walked up the steps, what was behind home plate. Naturally, I didn't know that at the time. And I looked and I saw a baseball field and I said, Mom, there's a baseball field in this building. Because all I had done was pitch in a little league park or something in a park where you didn't have fences. And I said, I'm going to play here someday. And she said to me, she said, Edward, you are if you're good enough. Ed, it's been my address almost my whole life at Comiskey Park and now US Cellular Field. So when I told her that, I didn't know it would get to a morph where I was actually doing the play-by-play on the radio.
Why the White Sox and not the Cubs?
I grew up as a White Sox fan. I never had any animosity towards the Cubs. I they didn't win when I would watch them on TV and I thought I was jinxing them. But I got to meet some of the players my first spring. I was in big league camp and made the Cleveland Indians at 18. And Jerome Holtzman, a noted reporter in Chicago, was just a great guy.
Baseball, he was the official historian of Major League Baseball.
Absolutely, and Hall of Fame. And Jerome sent over Ron Santo and Ferguson Jenkins. And I got to know those guys, and Ferguson Jenkins said to me, he goes, you pitched against our AAA team yesterday. I said, I did, they were in Scottsdale at the time, the Cubs were. And I said, I did. He goes, how many did you strike out? I said, I struck out 12 in 6 innings. And he said to me, how many pitches did you throw? I didn't even know what he was talking about. And I said, I don't know, but enough to strike out a dozen. He goes, how many runs you give up? I said, one. He goes, how many hits you give up? I said, one. He goes, the guy hit a home run? I said, yeah. He goes, they should hit home runs. Let them hit home runs. Just keep throwing strikes. I said, why do you say that? He goes, I pitched six innings like you did yesterday. I threw 45 pitches. Years later, Jenkins was my teammate with the Texas Rangers.
Right.
Yeah.
You were a schoolboy legend in Chicago in the Catholic League at St. Rita's.
I was fortunate enough to get Joe Porvecchio as a baseball coach and Father O'Malley. I actually took the exam at Mount Carmel High School, and my mother took me out of my neighborhood where I was playing, and I went down and played with the kids four neighborhoods over. That's something that didn't really work in Chicago, because once you cross barriers, they denote that by parishes, that Catholic parish, and I crossed four of those. You had a chance to get beat up in every one of those parishes. But when you're 6'3" and 195 pounds when you're 13...
And a great athlete.
There's not many guys who are going to fool with you, and I always had a pass. I'd go into the neighborhoods on the east side to play basketball with the kids over there, predominantly black kids, and they were great players. But if I wanted to play with them, I had to play good. And that's where I learned how to play basketball. Baseball was taught to me by Joe Porvecchio, the coach at St. Rita, and also Father O'Malley. And there was no funny stuff. None whatsoever. And thank goodness for those guys. I took the exam at Mount Carmel, played with them during the summer, and I took myself to St. Rita, where I had a scholarship there to play football and basketball. And they didn't have one for baseball. They were kind enough to give me one. I come from a family of nine children in Chicago. And not that we needed money all the time, but it didn't hurt me getting a scholarship to a Catholic high school.
Was baseball always number one?
Yeah, always. I fell in love with it. I couldn't play, and I had to teach the kids across the alley. They had to teach me how to throw and catch. And I thought it was the greatest sport that I'd ever been involved with. And it still is. It's a great sport. We had a boy. I'll tell you a quick story, Ed. We had a boy. He had polio, so he had the Forrest Gump braces on, and he was not a good baseball player. And my mom was sitting behind home plate. He struck out every time. My mom would cheer for all the kids. She had probably six or seven kids, her kids, and probably one more that she was pregnant with. And I was yelling at this kid, come on, Bobby, with no sincerity whatsoever. And she said to me, Edward, come over here. I was eight, and I was approaching 6 feet tall. And she said, you see this boy? I said, yeah, that's Bobby, so-and-so. And she said, he's got more guts than anybody. I don't want you to embarrass this boy. I said, Mom, he strikes out every time. He's not getting on him. We're going to lose. She goes, be ready, because he's going to walk. And I don't want you to embarrass him. Well, the 3-2 pitch is a walk. And as I'm going in the batting cage there, you know, it was pitch then. It wasn't T-ball or anything like that. I thought my mom knew everything, because she knew he was going to walk. And he'd never been on base before. So I fall the first pitch off. My mother yelled at me, Edward, let's go. Hit the ball in a Babe Ruth diamond across the park. So the right fielder's like 3'4", and I'm approaching 6 feet. And I hit this line drive over his head. It goes across the park. So I'm running, because Bobby Wyatt's the tie and run. And I round first, and I turn. He's right there, and I hear his braces squeaking. And I said, Bobby. And I look, and the kid that's in right field isn't halfway across the park. And it dawns on me at that time, he's going to get to that backstop. Bobby's going to be probably at shortstop. Who's going to throw the ball all the way across the park? He's going to score. And I tell Bobby, I go, Bobby, walk all the way around the bases. You're going to score the winning run. Walk around the bases. You know, you never know how you affect people's lives when you're playing sports. And the kids put him on their shoulders because he won the game with his run. And they put him on their shoulders. 6 years ago, I got a message, a printed letter from him. He was in the stands, and he wrote it just with a pen. And he says, I'm watching you do the play-by-play on the radio. I love listening to you. I never got a chance to thank you. You made me feel like one of the boys for the first time in my life. Thank you so much. Those are the things that count.
What a great story. A lot of medicine in your family. Yeah. And you almost went to medical school.
I still go. They've been very kind to me at Harvard. I'm 26 years post-transplant on a kidney.
We're going to talk about that in a moment.
Yeah, and I'm going back in the lab. I was in the lab last year, and I found something that I thought was interesting. And I found how T lymphocytes, your body's mechanism to ward off flus, foreign bodies like a transplant, viruses, little inflammations. I found out that my T cells react differently. A living-related recipient I'm one from my brother Tom, who's got the same DNA as I do from my mom and my dad. Mm-hmm. They react differently. After 8 months, I could take you off immunosuppression slowly, very slowly, but within a year, you won't be taking immunosuppression.
Did kidney disease run in your family?
Yeah, I have one regret. My mother died at 37. I signed the contract in her hospital room to go play, and she never got to see me play in the big leagues or anywhere else. And
you signed your first professional contract.
Yeah, when it's the little company Mary Hospital in Evergreen Park, Illinois, at the age of 17, and I went to rookie ball that year. Came home from my mother's funeral.
What was wrong with her?
She had polycystic kidneys, which I have. It's the number one genetically passed disease in the world, and we've got some things that are working right now. We'll probably be able to take that organic molecule that causes that genome. There's two of them. They run in chromosome 4 and 6. In chromosome 4, the genome is on the long arm of that genome. Chromosome 6, it's on the short arm. We could take that organic molecule, synthesize it, and put it back in there, and you'll never have polycystic kidneys on that individual. That's what's working now.
Where are you on the stem cell debate?
The stem cells? There's not a debate for me. 5 or 6 years, by my calculation, I'll be able to take your stem cell, and I'll be able to grow all of your core organs. I can grow your own heart. I'll be able to grow your own kidney, your own pancreas, your own lungs, your own liver. And you won't be on immunosuppression because it'll be your own DNA. I don't know where I'm going to store these things, but it could conceivably be that you'd have your own storage unit in your house, and if something happened to you, I could just go there and harvest those organs and give them to you.
How did that fight for your life change your life?
The first question I asked Dr. Ted Steinman at Harvard, the head nephrologist, I said, am I going to die? So I went from 220, where I pitched at, to 163. And he goes, yes. I said, okay. He said, not from this disease. I said, well, then let's go to work. So how did it change my life? I would say that I'm more accessible from some. I'm still not good in crowds, as you know. I'm not good in crowds. I'm good in front of them or when there's a barrier, but my head's on a swivel all the time. But I'm more generous, I think, now because I know what's going on. We're all in this together, as you know, with prostate cancer and everything that we've gone through. I can help people, and that's what I'm going to do before I leave this earth.
And you've done a lot of work. We're with Ed Farmer, the noted voice of the Chicago White Sox. You've done a lot of work with regard to this advocacy work.
I've done what they've let me do. They've been very generous to me with Ted Steinman, Terry Strom at Harvard Med, and I'm going to be in there for 3 days out of the 4 days we're at Fenway Park in Boston. And there's an individual that I have to take his son with me because he needs to see a pediatric nephrologist, and I've got the guy right for him. The fellows that I have at Harvard, they're at the top of the class in every place.
When did you first notice that you weren't like all the other kids? When I was in the year before we met, I was in the New York Penn League. Yeah. And I will never forget our league president, Vince McNamara, referring to the players as being, quote, touched by God. I never forgot that. They're different.
Yeah.
You were different. When did you first have a recognition that you were different and that you had professional talent?
Yeah, I never recognized that. My coach was my summer coach also. His brother was a detective in Area 3 in Chicago. And the best team that played when I was 15, the 15, 16, 17-year-old kids, then they went 18, 19, 20 and above. That was Stan Musial. The best team in Chicago at that time was a team called the Fernwood Bruins. And my baseball coach, long before I got to him, started a team that was inner-city kids just to play them and beat them. So he took the best talent. And his brother told me about 6 years ago before he passed away, he goes, do you remember when you became a relief pitcher? I said, no. He said, we're playing the Fernwood Bruins over there, and my brother told you to go warm up in the sixth inning. I said, I remember that, because I said, me? And he took both hands, like, shoving me away. He goes, yeah, go warm up. And I was warming up in the trees, you know. In the parks, you have no bullpen. And I said, Sal, how did I do? He goes, well, you came in with the bases loaded. We're ahead 3-2. I said, and? He goes, 9 pitches later, the inning was over. You struck out the side. I said, oh, who pitched the seventh? He goes, you pitched the seventh, but not as well. I said, oh, what happened? He goes, well, you threw a ball. You threw 10 pitches. You struck out at all 6 batters and threw 19 pitches. I said, oh. He goes, and I went to my brother, this guy's going to pitch in the big leagues, and he's going to be a short reliever. Truer words were never spoken, because as a starter, I just felt that the Chicago White Sox, who I grew up loving, all the fans were counting on me. They were counting on me. My brothers and sisters were counting on me to get them out, as well as my friends. I couldn't let down my 24 teammates either. So until I got real sick with kidney disease in 81, I was on a mission. And I was on a mission to make the All-Star team in 1980 because I had rotator cuff surgery, and the guys in my neighborhood in California took the time to play catch with me so I could come back. So I devised this plan. I'm going to make the All-Star team. They want to go to it. It's being played at Dodger Stadium. It's sold out. I'll make the team. So I wrote down 17 saves and 5 wins on a piece of paper that October. I looked at it once each month, October, November, December, January, February, went to spring training. We started with the Orioles at Chicago. I think I saved one or two of the first three games and won one. And I looked at that piece of paper that day, and I never looked at it again. When Lee McPhail called me a week before the All-Star team, he said, "You're leading baseball with 17 saves and 5 wins." Exactly what I wrote down on that piece of paper. I went to the game at 6-1 as we won a game late on that Sunday. And I went at 17 saves and 6-1. And right after that, we were in Kansas City. And I knew that one of my cysts on my kidneys had popped.
And Willie Randolph made an error behind you in that All-Star game, didn't he?
It was a tough play. What a great guy. What a great friend. People say to me, Randolph made an error. I could care less. The play of the game was Pete Rose hitting one to him. They gave the pass backwards to Robin Yount, the shortstop. If you look at that video, I still have it in my mind. I don't have to look at the video. Robin Yount, one of my roommates, he threw out Pete Rose to complete the double play, 4-6-3, flat-footed. People think of Yount, the ones who remember him playing as a center fielder.
Right.
He was an all-star shortstop as well. Yeah.
Yes, he was. I missed him by a year in the New York Penn League. Yeah. You have a photographic memory. When did you first recognize that?
I started memorizing everything when I was a kid. I remember most of the golf that I played. Remember certainly a lot of the holes. The gin games that we played with Mike Schmidt, Pete Rose, with Richie Osborne when I was with Philadelphia. I remember every card that was played. But in school, someone said to me, it's within the last month, I said, when did you learn how to speak Spanish? I said, in high school. I took Spanish. I don't remember anything. I said, well, I walked in the first day, didn't know what we were saying. And he said hello to me in Spanish. The Spanish teacher said, ¿cómo está? I didn't know how to answer him. The next day he said, ¿cómo está? I said, muy bien, y tú, which means I'm good, how are you? I got an A in his class. So I kept Spanish. Now I speak with all the players, the Cubans, Latinos, everybody. Cuban Spanish is a little different. When I went to the Dominican Republic and Puerto Rico and Venezuela, I just spoke Spanish with the guys, and I wasn't the American or the gringo. It was fun. And Manny Ramirez, one of my dear friends, he didn't know I spoke Spanish. And when I told him, he said to me, he goes, they're going to watch what I'm saying.
I was going to say, to be a lot more careful being around you. But is it the kind of memory like I remember as a kid, Jerry Lucas, when he came to New York to play for the Knicks with the great Knicks player. Teams, and they said he could memorize the Manhattan phone book when there was such a thing.
I'm pretty sure Bill Bradley from Princeton could do the same thing. And I had a follow-up. We were here 2 weeks ago playing the Yankees, and a friend of mine brought a man up there that's in the theatrical district here. He takes care of the actors and hires them for different plays, like Hamilton. That play, he's hired him for that. He said to me, do you want to go see Hamilton tonight? I said, well, I've got other plans, but when we come back. I said, well, we've got a day off. We got a day off leaving. He goes, that's a dark day. I don't know what that meant, but I know they weren't working. And he listened to the broadcast, and he goes, you write nothing down. I said, I do. I keep score. He goes, but where does this stuff come from? I said, well, I memorize this stuff before the game. Mike Mullen, I had up there with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. I still have his bio in my mind. Yeah, he graduated from Notre Dame High School in the San Fernando Valley in California, won in his class, then went to the military academy in Annapolis, where he graduated magna cum laude there. He was the head of Pacific Fleet, the Gulf Fleet, Gulf of, not the Gulf of Mexico, the Persian Gulf, and also the Atlantic Fleet. And he answered to President of the United States in all military affairs.
How has that helped you in your job?
I don't miss a beat. I don't have to refer to things, although I don't want to be right all the time. Nobody is. And when I'm wrong, I'll certainly admit that. Mm-hmm. But I'll ask Darren. I said, you know, I think I read this, and he'll either confirm it or say, no, you didn't do that. I actually like that a lot more than if I'm right most of the time.
Baseball is a linear game, as you know.
Yes.
One thing leads to another,
leads to another.
Right. Do you feel that you can anticipate better than other people?
I've never done that. Never said, yeah, well, I think this is going to happen. I'll say, this is a chance here to do this. And if it happens, it's almost like I'm predestined to say that. And it happens a lot. But then again, I've seen so many baseball games. You think you've seen everything. We've had two triple plays this year. And I had a read earlier in the year, triple plays are brought to you by Xfinity. X1 will change the way that you experience TV. And I took the all out of there. Because if you get a triple play in a season, you've seen a lot. Now we've had one in April, one here in May, which May ends today. June will probably have another one. You know, I mean, so now I read all triple plays.
You mentioned the Yankees earlier. Maybe it's unfair to bring this up on the air, but you've always hated the Yankees.
Well, they used to be my White Sox. All the players I met from New York, I played golf 3 years ago with Whitey Ford. What a great guy.
Oh, the best.
Yeah.
And I roomed with his son in Elmira my first year in the minor leagues. I know the family well.
That was Elmira, New York.
Yes,
when
sir.
I played in Elmira, I was 18. That was Double A.
Beautiful. You're right. Yeah. It was in the Eastern League. And Weaver managed there. Davey Johnson played there.
All those.
Exactly right.
Did I hate the Yankees? No, but I thought it was a compromise of my facts by being traded there to go there because I didn't like them. And Steinbrenner asked me, you know, long before he got sick, he said to me, Eddie Einhorn, who one of my dear friends who put college basketball on TV, a great guy, one of our owners, has passed away from basically kidney disease. That's what started it.
And he had prostate cancer.
He did. And he introduced me to George Steinbrenner. I said, Mr. Steinbrenner, it's so nice to meet you. He goes, I had you, didn't I? I said, you did. He goes, I don't remember you wearing the Yankee pinstripes. I said, I didn't come. And, you know, Eddie, he looked at me like I'd done something to a family member. I'm not kidding. He looked at me like, are you kidding me? I said,
who
no.
would turn that down?
Well, that's basically what he said to me. He goes, you didn't want to be a Yankee? I go, no. He goes, why is that? I said, you guys used to beat my White Sox all the time. I hated you guys, but you had great teams. He goes, this is a great game, isn't it? I said, it certainly is. He goes, you enjoyed beating me, didn't you? I said, absolutely.
Tell the time about you're a kid with the Cleveland Indians, you're with your mom, and you can't get into Yankee Stadium.
Yeah, I'm not with the Indians yet. I was 11. We'd gone to Williamsport, Pennsylvania to view the Little League World Series. And
let me re-ask the question. But there was an incident that involved you and your inability to get into Yankee Stadium as a kid.
Yeah, that's true. We had been to the Little League World Series, not as participants. My mother actually took me there because you're going to play here someday. She had that kind of vision. I don't know where that came from, but she did. And she had a lot of other visions. It's, thank God they didn't come true. But so my dad's friend passed away in the Bronx, a fellow, Jewish fellow. And
he went to go sit Shiva.
He went to the Shiva. And he said, take the boys. My brother Tom and Dan were with me. And he said, take the boys wherever they want to go because I'm going to go in here and console the family. I didn't even know what was going on, you know. So he went into the house, and my mom goes, where do you want to go? I want to go see Yankee Stadium because I've watched it on TV. I want to go see it. And she pulled up on the sidewalk, which was behind the left field bullpen. And at that time, the bullpens, you would throw down towards the field. There was a little fence in front of the bullpen that was lower than the fences around it. Center field was about 463 at the time,
yes,
with the monuments in play and a flagpole. So my mom, you know, she doesn't know any better. She knocks on a corrugated metal door, which was the back end of the bullpen for the visitors. And it actually goes up. A man comes out, he goes, what can I do for you? She goes, my three boys would like to see Yankee Stadium. You know, as innocent as she could say it. And he goes, the Yankees are on the road. I can't do that. I'll lose my job. And she said, see, I was 6'1". I was 11. I was 6'1". She said, you see my big boy there? He's going to play here someday. He goes, how old is he? She goes, he's 11. Yeah. He's 11. He's a monster. You know, I thought there was something wrong with me. And he said, my mom took out $20. $20 at that time was a lot of money.
A lot of money.
She goes, you let my big boy in. He put his hand up, and his right hand had all the fingers on it. His left, he was missing his three last fingers. He had his index finger and his thumb. That was it. And he goes, I can't let him in. She goes, he's going to pitch here someday. And he goes, then I'll see Yankee Stadium then. I believe it was 8 years later. I'm warming up with the Cleveland Indians in that bullpen. And they had a Yankee card then that was white with blue pinstripes on it, and it had a an insignia on the front that was red, white, and blue, naturally the Yankees. I'm pretty sure the bat was going through a top hat on that, as I think back on it, going through the in a circle on the hood, and it said Yankees on it. And I got in the car, and the guy put his hand on the steering wheel to bring me into the game. I was in the game. And he was missing those three fingers.
My God, what a story.
And I said to him, I said, hey, you're the guy. My mom tried. He goes, are you okay? I said, yeah, but hold on. He goes, you got to come in the game. I said, I'm going in the game, okay. And I said, you're the guy who wouldn't let me in 9 years ago or 8 years ago for $20. He goes, that was you? I said, yeah. He goes, I'm taking it now. I said, you know what? I wasn't good enough then. You're not good enough now. He was from Yonkers, New York. He was on the Gruen crew, and Frankie and I became lifelong friends until he passed away about 4 years ago.
Sure. He was a legend on the Yankees grounds crew. A couple more moments with Ed Farmer. You pitched for 11 years in the major leagues, but there was a time when you also scouted. Prior to broadcasting with the Baltimore Orioles, did you see perhaps a career path that way?
I worked for Larry Lucchino and Roland Heyman. Roland Heyman was my general manager in Chicago. And I had to go with a fellow by the name of Bertie Tebbets that first year, who actually taught me how to evaluate talent. And it was a great job. It still is. You go look at players. They were grooming me to be the general manager in Baltimore. And I told Mr. Lucchino I really didn't want the job. And the White Sox had called.
Were you scouting amateur or professionals?
Everything.
Everything?
Everything, yeah. And Tebbets would say to me, he'd go, just listen to what I'm talking about. I said, okay. He goes, don't interrupt me. I said, I won't. So we're watching a pitcher in an instructional league pitch. We're coming back. He goes, what'd you think of him? What'd you think? His name was Arthur Rhodes, left-handed pitcher. I said, he reminds me of Vita Blue. Well, what do you mean by that? So I started telling him. And I said, but Bertie, he goes, shut up and listen to me. So we're driving back. And he for 10 minutes later, he goes, okay, what do you have to tell me? I said, our exit to go back to the offices was 9 miles back there.
Wow. And so you've broadcast since. You root for the team when you're on the air.
I hope so. They know I'm a White Sox fan. My broadcast tonight from here at Citi Field with the Mets, yesterday, if it was good, today has to be as good, if not better. That's what I believe, and I belong to do that. I long to do that for the fans. If I don't do that, I'm letting them down. I got here today.
You think they want you to root for the team on the air?
Well, I don't.
Not
I don't
be objective?
Say, I'll say, oh, I'm very objective. Yesterday, I said this about Matt Harvey. I saw him a couple years ago here. And he was dynamic. And I said, this guy is a young right-handed pitcher. He hasn't been I think he went to North Carolina. He went to North Carolina. I said, he's coming from a program that was really good. But this guy's got dynamic stuff. Since then, he's had elbow surgery. Now he's on the path back. And I read his numbers yesterday. I think it was 53 and a third innings with 70-plus hits. And he walked 18. And I said, everybody's telling me, he's not throwing good. He's doing this. He's doing that. I said, well, I'm going to see what he's doing, because if that's him, I want to see what he's doing. He threw a one-hitter against us for 7 innings. So that's the same Matt Harvey I saw. Sandy Alderson, one of my dear friends, is running a show here with the Mets. I'm sure he's got a myriad of phone calls, not yet today, but the last 2 months, because I know this. If I'm scouting and he was throwing poorly, I'd still want Matt Harvey.
There is a bond between the broadcaster on radio and the fan, unlike anything in sports.
Yes.
Do you wish you had ever done television?
I don't know that. I don't know that the TV is my place. I can carry a conversation with you for a while, as we're doing right now. I did MLB TV a couple weeks ago here, and Brian Kenny couldn't have been nicer to me. He really couldn't. And I got to tell you this. I didn't like his sabermetrics stuff. I used one thing from sabermetrics, whip. Walks, hits, innings pitched. And he couldn't have been nicer to me. He couldn't have been greater to me. The guys over there with Clifford Floyd and also Ken Rosenthal were on the panel with me. I thought I was going to be on for 15 minutes. I was on for an hour. And the amount of people that I got text messages after that, a number of them said, you're missing the boat. This medium that I'm doing now with Major League Baseball on the radio, I can create these things. And if my voice fluctuates when we're winning, I hope that's telling them that I love the White Sox. It's been my boyhood team. It's been my address my whole life. I don't want to, you know, I hate losing. If we're going to sit down and play, and I saw Magic Johnson last night on TV, and he was on the Kimmel show, and he said to Magic Johnson, he goes, so what do you think about that girl Parker, because he owns a pro basketball team, a women's NBA team, or WNBA, and he goes, what happens if Parker's playing you in a game to 10? He goes, will you lose? And he looks at Jimmy Kimmel, and he goes, Jimmy, what? Well, I lose. I'll let her get to 9. That's about as far as she's going.
And after your love of the White Sox, right behind it, not even 1-2, 1-1A is Notre Dame football.
Notre Dame football. I grew up on that campus. I love going there. I love what the university stands for. I had the first baseball scholarship in full offered by the university.
You signed with the Indians.
Yes, I did. So that scholarship was gone. But the things that have gone through my life to where I am today, you know, you asked me about doing the broadcasting. I've got a partner, Darren Jackson. He could do my job with no problem whatsoever. He's the analyst on this, and he does a great job. I'm not kidding you. He can make fun of me all he wants, and I start laughing. He's taking pictures of me because there's one thing I can do, and I'm sure you remember this. I can fall asleep on an airplane, a bus, just as long as I'm not driving. It is a good thing. But, yeah, and he takes pictures.
That hasn't changed.
No, I still don't want to fall asleep driving. I don't drink alcohol, never had. But it's a great job. But I've got to have my best friend next to me also outside of my family, Darren Jackson, or it doesn't work. We have a conversation. It's a different broadcast than most. And I know it doesn't appeal to everybody. But if you want to listen to White Sox baseball, we're going to help you through that. If you can put up with some of the gibberish, you're going to have a good time. And you might be smiling at home if you get some of the things we say.
You have no regrets.
One regret. My mother never got to see me pitch in the big leagues.
I am so happy to have you on the show. That's Ed Farmer, the longtime voice of the Chicago White Sox in his 25th year. Do you get anything on 25 years like they do in marriage?
Yeah, marriage. I'm past that, but I haven't got that yet for 25 years in marriage. But I've got 2 gold passes to go to see a Major League Baseball game, one for being a player and one now for being with the club 25 years. You know how many times I've used those passes? Zero.
Zero. Zippo. He's Ed Farmer. I'm Ed Randall. That'll do it for us on MLB.com. If you were listening on the move, thanks for the ride and thanks for listening to Ed Randall's Talking Baseball.